Because when I say, oh, yeah, I grew up in the gospel and the jazz tradition. But then sometimes I'm in a lot of interviews where they're like, what is it like to be a person of color in these very, and somebody just said it, well, interview not too long, in these very white spaces. And I'm just like, I've existed here since I was born. This is my destiny. I'm trying to normalize me being here for y'all.
Y'all hear that? Yeah, it's a little different, isn't it? But I kind of like it. You know, we get to try something new today, courtesy of today's guest, Brian Raphael Nabors. He's a composer, but I'll tell you a little bit more about it later. Let's just go on a ride for a bit. So Brian is a composer of contemporary concert music based out of Alabama. And man, this conversation is so dope. We got the chance to work together about a year and a half ago, and he's actually got me interested in the whole realm of classical and concert style music. And so we talk about the little variations of, you know, linguistics and the history of the music. We talk about him being a black composer, one of the very few, and what that upbringing was like for him. Brian is such an animated and welcoming and warm person. It's gonna, and I'm sure by the end of this conversation, you're gonna love some of the music too. So, and shout out to Brian for just sending the music over and giving you guys a taste of what it sounds like. So for those who are joining on video, thank you very much. I appreciate the support for the growth. A little disclaimer though, this is like the first time I actually tried video, so I was still trying to figure it out. So the quality is not gonna be that great. But moving forward, we're going to have y'all covered. Don't worry. A little side note, during this conversation, I had a bit of a cold, so my voice is a little bit scratchy. So just bear with me. Enough from me. Let's just jump into the conversation. I hope y'all enjoy it.
Yo, yo. What's up?
Hello, hello.
What's up, Brian? How you doing?
I'm all right. I'm hanging in there. A little tired, but yeah, same as usual.
Yeah.
Always working. Trying to figure out how to get more rest and balance it all. But I think right now I'm in a very, very good place.
I feel like as a creative too, since you're, I feel like you're probably like me where your mind never stops. Like in terms
never.
Of like you're listening, like even if you hear something, I don't know what, where you get your inspiration from. We can talk more specific about that a little bit, but like, yeah, even for me, I'm like thinking of, I'm like watch a movie and be like, wow, that was a really cool transition. Maybe I can apply it to like this project, or like I'll do something where I see like a garbage, like a Kroger or grocery bag blown in the wind. And I'm like, wow, let me actually talk about this because this is impacting our planet a certain way. Let me make a project that way. I don't know. Does it work that way for you in terms of music and composition too?
Oh my God, yes. Everything in the world. The trash bag is a piece for me. The way it bounces, literally. Off the ground and moves in the wind. It's like, oh, I'm going to take trash bags now and write the same piece about what we're doing to the earth, and then get a whole bunch of field recordings of these things in their natural environment. And just to literally show how the impact of somebody throwing some trash on the ground is the very fact that, you know, that's causing all of this, you know, chaos and hurt to the world. And it's like that really, whether it's videography or in music, it makes things so real for people when they're listening or looking or doing both. And it really centers them on just the message that, you know, we as creatives are trying to get out there. We try to make it real for the person so that they can change their actions for the better, hopefully, or just be inspired to do better or be better or think better. But everything from planes flying, you know, over, you know, where I live, to just taking the time out to go into like an area with nothing but streams and fish and giant cranes flying down. I'm like, okay, cool. And then being able to come back and even write, you know, something about the dichotomy of these two different worlds. I actually wrote an orchestral piece about that. It really, I think it was called Pulse. I should know my own music. It's a shame. My brain is dead.
It's okay. Anyway,
I wrote a piece called Pulse about the rhythm of the universe and how simultaneously, even here on Earth, more specifically, there are all of these rhythms that control so many ecosystems and environments, whether, you know, our very human kind of closed-minded one a lot of times. At the same time, there's animals out there literally like hunting each other down for survival.
Right.
And I'm like, nobody cares about any of that. And I'm looking up at the stars like, oh my God, we're so small. Look at all these galaxies. Look at, oh my God, the billions of stars within each one of those. Seriously. And I'm like, oh my God, what if we're being controlled by some type 5 and 6 civilization? Oh my God. So I watch space documentaries every night. And this is literally what I go to bed to. So I am constantly in a state of living in existential mind realms of just craziness. And it's like, why not think about these things? Because it's like, I can't just focus on, oh, I need to get money. I need to pay bills. I need blah. No, it's so much
it's
more.
It's bigger than
that.
Yeah.
It's so much more than that. And if I don't allow the art to come from that place, then I can't do this anymore. Anyway,
do you get to, like, I think that's interesting that you watch a lot of like space documentaries. Do you then get to, because you're, are you in Alabama?
Where? I am.
Okay.
I am.
So do you get a chance to actually see the stars afterwards too? Like, do you get to go outside, or are you more kind of in a condensed light polluted like area?
Definitely. I grew up in the suburbs. And so after I tried to go to Australia for a Fulbright, and I got there, and okay. Then, you know, COVID happened. Mm. And so I had to move back home. And so
I'm already there. Here.
I am here in my childhood bedroom. Ain't no shame in my game. I got a teaching job, you know, getting used to looking my parents in the face and being 30 was not fun after living in Cincinnati for like almost 7.5 years, you know, by myself. But it's cool. You know, I'm applying full-time positions. I'm hoping to get out of here soon.
Right.
Saving up a whole bunch of money. Ain't no shame.
Oh, yeah.
But I've always lived, well, we've always been in this area all my life, where it's kind of both worlds. We're right on the edge of the city limits of Birmingham, where you can drive literally 5 minutes down the road one direction and then go to a creek and, like I said, see all these cranes and these fish and everything, and literally drive the other direction and civilization, so-called, takes its toll, and you see all these businesses and gas and cars and all this, you know, the city, if it will. Yeah, it's a mixture of both. So I was always able to go outside, look up, and be in nature regardless. And then if we had to go somewhere, you know, we just had to go somewhere in the pollution. But I always got to come home to nature. So at night, it's not a lot of light around here, so you can look up and, you know, see the stars.
Yeah, just went to Traverse City for the weekend. And there's it's so close to the water. That's like nature central too. Like, they have like a small town, but there's not a ton. Like, it's you're there to kind of get away and be out in nature. Like, they got sand dunes and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But at nighttime, we went to like a beachy area where there's absolutely no light. The only light is the light you produce. And I had never seen it so clear before. And like, you're talking about the millions upon millions upon millions upon stars. I actually got to see the Milky Way. You can see it there, and it's like, it changes your whole perspective about everything. It's like, dude, this stuff is always here, and we're all worried about our little things here, but there's such a big universe that's literally here, and it's, you know, so much else going on. So it's indeed, just like, it changes your perspective for sure.
Absolutely. Whenever I look up, oh, Jesus, I can't always see the Milky Way from where I am. But I think the first time I actually got a glimpse of, you know, that famous picture where you see the globs of gases and all the, I think I was in Massachusetts, maybe just about 2 months ago. And that was literally the first time it was dark enough for me to see absolutely everything. I was like, oh my God, there it is. Yeah, like you said, it's so much.
Yeah.
So much we'll never, if our calculations are right and everything is as far apart as it actually is, which I believe it is, but so much we'll never know. I feel like it'll be revealed to us after we die.
So yeah, I want to go back to Alabama a little bit. You got your family there and you grew up there. Was your family always like musical, or how did you like, what was it like growing up in Alabama? You told us a little bit, but yeah.
Indeed. My mom is a church musician. She's been on the organ since she was about 13 years old. And my father and my mother, both of their families, they went to the same church. And so they grew up knowing each other, seeing each other. My father was he is still a visual artist, and did a lot of writing and painting and a whole bunch of those things. He became a preacher and ended up getting the call and serving a full time as a pastor. Eventually, you know, gave up, you know, the mechanical shipping job that he had just down the street, because there's a lot of plants and stuff like down the road, and eventually just did full-time pastoring. But then I was used to my mom growing up. She's also a registered nurse, but I'm used to her being on the organ every Sunday when we go to church. So she's pregnant with me, still playing the organ. So I like to tell people I've been a musician since I was in the womb. But after I actually was born and got here, my life was very musical growing up because of that, you know, gospel environment. Other than that, my mom tried to keep us very cultured. She took us to my sister and I, that is, to different plays, Broadway performances when they would visit town. You know, I got to see Lion King. I saw, you know, other little fun stuff. Disney on Ice as a child. You go and get like a little lightsaber stuff. Just stuff like that. Children's theater. A lot of school performances happen too, but she always had us going somewhere. So I heard all these sounds all the time in my head. And so I used to just run around outside and just make up little songs like it was the soundtrack of my life while I was looking up at the stars of the sunset. And I didn't know why I got little tingles. And it seems kind of lame now, but then I understand completely spiritually, you know, where that comes from now. And so it was very much like that. And so just after that, you know, I took to piano very quickly, and that was the first thing I ever touched as far as a musical instrument. And so I just learned things by ear. I was just hitting like little notes, single finger, just going, you know, old McDonald had a form until it turned in the two, then three, then four, then five, even six or seven notes in one hand at this point. But I think around the time I was 13, I actually started taking actual piano lessons. Like before, it was just by ear, and I was doing so many things wrong. I was playing chords all crooked, you know, fingers all twisted up. My teachers were very strict on me to correct all that stuff. And so while I was learning some of these concepts, I started to stumble into writing my own stuff. And it started out me just making up songs here and there. But then after that, I tried to write them down with a pencil or a pen on like the little scratch notebook paper, blank staff paper in the back of my little method book that came with my piano lessons. And I quickly discovered that the theory behind that was totally wrong. I had notes all in the wrong positions, just stuff that you wouldn't be able to read, but I could read it. but it kind of spiraled into me getting this little cheap $30 notation software that I begged my mama for when I was 16. I was like, please let me have this notation software. I want to really, really learn how to score the music that I'm hearing in my head. I feel like I need to get this out of me. And so she's like, okay, fine. So she gave me her credit card, went in and got the software. It was horrible. Like I was clicking one note at a time because I didn't know anything about MIDI keyboards or how to hook up any of that stuff. So I wrote everything from orchestral pieces to choir pieces to everything you can think of, little piano works. And it ended up being a giant portfolio of stuff before I even had the theory or the know-how, because I was just teaching myself as I went, combined with the lessons I was taking at the local conservatory. And then when I was 16, I had a battle because I was like, I don't know if I want to be an architect or a composer, because I draw like my father and I like designing. And I was going to this architecture firm every Saturday, downtown Birmingham. We were building light fixtures and everything. So I was doing that. I was in the Math Honor Society of School, very nerdy sort of calculatory thing. And so I just stopped going on Saturdays. I was just like, Daddy, I don't want to do this anymore. So he just stopped taking me. I don't even think I told the firm that I wasn't coming anymore, because I knew that I had to be in a mood to do some math problems on a Saturday morning to figure out how a light fixture works or how to measure this stuff out. But if it was music, you could wake me up 3 o'clock a.m. and I could just write and just produce something I was proud of, no matter how long it took me to shelve it out. And I knew then that it's like the Lord whispered to me, you know, the creator said, you're a composer, just go for it. Trust me on this, you're a composer. And I was like, you know what? I am a composer. I can't run from this anymore. And so I just didn't. And I declared, you know, my major composition, and I've been going ever since. And it has not failed me. And that's how I knew that my destiny kind of chose me. I'm very fortunate, because a lot of people, you know, they have to go through life in a different way to figure out exactly what their path is, which isn't a bad situation, because we all got our struggles, no matter if you get them early in life or in the middle or much later. But we all kind of end up in the same place. But we tend to screw things up when we just really want to do things our way. But I was very lucky that he gave me an assignment immediately from the jump that was like, look, you're supposed to write music. Nobody who looks like you, who's from where you're from, is seeking to write music for the stage like you. And I didn't know none of that at the time. I just knew I needed to write music. All that stuff kind of came later. But long story short, college, grad school, you know, beginning of a professional career, here I am still writing.
I think that's interesting. So my I guess one thing I want to know, like, did you know that, like, did you have an idea that classical, because do you call yourself classical, a classical composer? Like, what is your kind of genre that you feel you fit into?
Ooh, this is a whole dissertation, because I'll say this quickly. In our field right now, we're having struggles because there are so many like cross-pollination of styles happening in the concert hall that we're even rethinking what in the world is classical music. You know, is it just like this European construct that all that music was just brought over here? What about the American classical music? And now we're starting to think, well, why don't we just call it, you know, contemporary concert music? That's really what it is. I like that term better, but I guess, yeah, absolutely. Because it's more inviting, right? It gets people in the door who feel otherwise excluded, like I don't have a place here, you know, no matter who you are in your background. It just, it feels more inviting because more people are writing that way, which I'll probably tell you about in a minute. But in terms of like a general sort of aesthetic to get, I guess, the more astute crowd interested in what I do, I usually say, yeah, you can call me, you know, contemporary, classical or whatever, but I've started refuting all of it. I'm just like, nah, I'm just a concert composer. I write music for orchestras and the stage and people who have been trained what we call classically. So I guess you can call me that if you want to.
Okay.
Nah, it's so interesting.
I like that, actually. I'm going to switch it up. Contemporary concert. Because I think classical holds it back so much. Like, it's more, it grasps onto the traditional aspect of it. And I think from what I've heard, from what you compose and put together, it is very much anti everything that kind of you would anticipate if you were to listen to quote unquote classical music. And so,
oh, that makes me happy.
Yeah. So I think that you have like the foundations. Like, I don't know anything technically about how to build music or whatever. I don't know that. But from my perspective, I think you've got kind of like the foundation, and you pay homage to that era of music and that style and that genre, but you take it in a whole different lane that you can't associate these two with, like, you can't associate them together, in my opinion. But
hey, yeah. I love that.
Yeah.
I love that view. It's perfect because it invites everybody to the hall. Because when I say, oh yeah, I grew up in the gospel and the jazz tradition, but then sometimes I'm in a lot of interviews where they're like, what is it like to be a person of color in these very, and somebody just said it, well, interview not too long ago, in these very white spaces. And I'm just like, I've existed here since I was born. This is my destiny. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to normalize me being here for y'all. I want y'all to feel better about this, but I love that view because it opens up the door for everybody to feel welcome, so that when you want to come and you want to experience music in this vein, that it's not so weird or foreign. Nobody's looking at you strange. It's like you got the representation, but sometimes it's hard because you don't want to be the representation all the time. It's like, maybe I want to write the fairy unicorn piece. Maybe I don't want to write the thing based off of the trauma and the history and the blah, blah, blah. I will, because it's very much a part of me, but I'll write it from my point of view. I think if we all let our little light shine respectively as creatives, it'll all just kind of mesh together. But of course, you know, we got to do our work.
You talked about that pressure. I talk about this a lot too, as an artist myself. Like, when you are like a Black artist, people want you to make Black art. But even though all art that we make is Black art, they want it to be about the struggle and the traumatic experiences. And but, you know, and that stuff is very much a part of the makeup of who we are. So it's going to come out naturally. But also, indeed, I think it's equally as important, if not, to show the versatility that we offer. I think what you're doing is great. I think if we want to do something where, you know, there's like, you know, Black video game designers or whatever you want to call it, that's equally as allowed. And I think that I push that type of work even more. We should have more freedom to do stuff like that, so that we can paint a fuller picture of who we are. Because if we just keep talking about the trauma and whatnot, people are going to listen and hear us, but they're only going to think that we care about that part of our existence, which is very important, but there's more to it than that. So
indeed, it's like you see folks only through the trauma lens, and it's like you can't escape it. And a lot of times folks will ask, even me, and I'm sure you might have gotten this too, just about your art. And it's like, is it going to be jazzy, or is it going to be this, or is it, I mean, I'm like, yes, because of my cultural upbringing.
Right.
But as far as like determining what Blackness is, well, like you said, I'm like, it's Black because I'm writing it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, totally. If it sounds something even totally foreign to you, like, it's still Black. I'm like, that's another extension of Blackness. And you can still attach Black to it because it's literally who we are. Like, I grew up literally a child of the South. My parents were like literal people who had to follow Jim Crow laws as children. And they tell me these stories about places that they could and could not go and all this stuff. So all that's buried within me. The not total resentment, but the history and the importance of that is buried within me. And sometimes it makes me sad when, you know, you go to certain environments and they're like, oh, you can't be totally Black. You speak too well. You can't be totally Black because, you know, you don't have the same swag or the same this or the same that. I'm like, look, I got my own swag.
Right.
It's on this contemporary classical music concert hall. So if you come in the hall, guess what? You may hear a piece that I wrote that has the orchestra turn into an HBCU marching band. Don't play with me. Like, seriously, I'm writing a concerto for orchestra. That was one of my big projects. And it's just like, I'm pulling aspects of how I grew up and the worlds I was in into the concert hall so that we can normalize, you know, us being there and normalize just the diversity. And I hate that word all the time in some circles, but it's the truth. The diversity of just not only people in general, but who we are as one people. It's an incredible thing where you can start to see yourself everywhere. And I think I reached a point not too long ago where I was like, okay, why not me? I can see myself absolutely anywhere, and I can take this orchestra and I have an even better advantage because I have so much other stuff that has influenced me as a person that I can add to this. And there is a buffer, a relationship that the people who have never heard anything like that sonically can see, because they see the orchestra on stage. They're used to seeing an orchestra. They're used to hearing new music, but to have grooves and rhythms and the life that, you know, Black culture brings, to include that in such an interesting way, such a developed and, well, it's already developed, but such a, I guess, how can I say, I don't know really how to describe it in terms of classical music, definitely a more, I guess, a different lens. I would just say different. It's just different because we don't need anything to validate us. It's just different.
Right. I think you're right. And I think this in my head a lot too, is like, I feel like, you know, Black people have probably lived like 2 or 3, 4 times the lives that, let's just say, like the majority white folks have lived, because of all the cultural influences that we pull in. Like we have the, there's this like TikTok meme, like there's a conversation that people say white people have no culture. And so there's a TikTok meme where white people are like, they like try to prove that they have culture. So they'll yes. show like somebody in like a polo shirt and then like some Crocs and like something goofy, like some like jean shorts. I don't know. It always, it's like, it's a joke. But the, yeah. but there's a conversation that like there's a lack of culture within the white space. But I think it's so interesting that for us as Black people, we have to be somewhat experts on that culture as well as the culture that we have already built and created yes. as well. So it's like we are so well-rounded as people just by sheer existing and having to
yeah.
cope with all this stuff that, like, now we're seeing the benefits. Like, you're able to do what you can do because you understand how to operate in this European space. Indeed. But also you pull the influences from what you brought up and other things that you've seen in your own community. And it's like, it's, we're creating things that people have never seen before. I think
that's so good.
That I see it a lot in the, I think as of recent, Black artists are winning right now. One, because a lot of the bigger corporations and organizations are feeling like guilty. So they're bringing us on. At the same time, we have, we're taking these opportunities and we're showing up and we're showing out because we are just so dope, like just yeah. naturally by just existing in multiple spaces, that now we're getting this chance and we're finally showing what we've always been capable of doing. And sure, like we're taking it like, because people are feeling guilty, but now we're like, oh, cool, this is us now. We're going to take this over. And, you know, exactly. that's something I've seen as a recent.
Indeed. And I thought it was just something that we were going through in the music world, but oh, it's everywhere. Mm-hmm. And I love that part about always, what we've always been doing. yeah. Because folks have always been either inspired or they've taken and tried to make something else out of it. It's so interesting. But yeah, I've also noticed just even in our own field, like even after, you know, everything that happened last year, not only with COVID, but with George Floyd and Elijah McClain and some of these Ahmaud Arbery, mm-hmm. all the hashtags, all the extra people that should not have been things to begin with. It's like, folks want to meet their DEI or diversity, equity, inclusion mm-hmm. quota. But at the same time, we're just actually just being as dope as we always have been. But I love it when you said just to have the time to actually shine and not shine because we feel like we have to be 10 billion times better. It's like there have been so much going on that the fuel has just been, you know, at a surplus for us to get back out there and just claim our story in a completely re-energized way. But I don't think that ever stopped. I think we've always been doing that. But I think even just at this point, it's like, okay, y'all want to be on Black culture? Well, I got something for you.
Yes.
And it's going to blow your mind much bigger than you just filling your quota. So I'm like, I don't mind folks filling their quota. I mind tokenism.
Yeah.
So I'm like, yeah, you can play this piece everywhere. Play it a billion times just because And it could be just because I'm black, just because you want to feel it. But guess what? I know that within my heart of hearts, why I wrote that piece will do its job and knock down the barriers I need to knock down. I'm working behind the scenes without anybody even really knowing, you know, what I'm doing for real, for real.
Right.
So I'm just like, this is such bigger work. So I'm just like, I'm gonna let y'all think what you're thinking. The ones that are just kind of doing it just because they need to do it, or want to feel like included, or that they're doing their part to do the right thing. I'm like, let them do what they do. But yeah, I'm gonna keep doing what I do as well.
Exactly.
And I'm gonna keep empowering others to do the same. So it's a beautiful time. But oh yeah, now I remember what else I wanted to say about that really quick. It got really hard when commissioning organizations and different bodies would reach out to Black composers specifically. Oh, we love a work from you, blah, blah, blah. We then had to discern, are you doing this mainly for your quota? Or are you doing this because you really, really care? It depends on the energy for me. Like, if I feel like it's just, you know, something not totally phony, but because it's hard to tell, but you can always tell by the energy whether or not somebody's just trying to so-called do the right thing on paper, or if they really care and they're doing the work. It's like you almost have to do your research as a composer or a creative or an artist to go, okay, let me dig into this organization. If I see that their programming has literally just been, you know, the classics or the masters forever and ever and ever, and then you start to see little speckled composers that are my colleagues, you know, just often, all of a sudden, I'm like, okay, you haven't been doing this work at all. But if I go through and I see, you know, in years past, a history of commissioning new music from underrepresented voices because it was something that they felt in their mission that was a part, or if they may have recently started to do this, but then that's when I'll, you know, talk a little bit more about the project and get right in people's heads and see what's going on. But if it's a good history there, then I'm okay with it. But normally you can always tell just by a number of different elements.
Right.
Yeah.
Like, wait, y'all, I'm the first Black person y'all ever brought, or, you know, exactly. Or not, y'all haven't even,
you're the good Black person.
Yeah, exactly. Y'all ain't even brought no women on.
Exactly. Nothing. No women.
Yeah.
No, you know, trans composers, no people who have different perspectives on life.
Yeah.
You know, it's about all of us.
So I just want to ask quickly though, in terms of like family and in within our own community, when you started to kind of go down this lane in the contemporary concert genre, did you get any sort of like, were there any barriers or any pushback from folks within the community too? Or was it like, what was that experience like?
Interestingly enough, maybe it's because of where I'm from and something about the South, they'll rally behind their own. But then there are a lot of places where folks who they'll hate, but they'll hate in silence, or sometimes, I don't know, it depends on what age you are. When I was, I will say mostly in grade school all the way through high school, when I was tapping into that part of myself, I went to a very, very Black high school.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, all Black elementary all the way through, you know, to the high school level. And you were a lame, you weren't cool. You were called all sorts of names. If you liked show tunes or, you know, were a little bit too, you know, energetic in your gestures, like you had to be hard. You had to be a thug. You had to be a gangster.
Yeah.
You know, but most time, you know, I think it got easier, like the older that we all got, because we all kind of grew up together. But it was extremely hard in elementary school because kids just don't understand
right
that people are different and come from different households and different people's situations, whether it be with family or just different economic stuff. You know, it's nobody's fault. It's just the history of how this country has just treated us and played out. And so I understood that, which made me feel okay, you know, being the victim as a child in a lot of these situations. I was very fortunate. I had two parents in the home, that kind of deal. And I just saw the world differently. And so my whole mission has been to reach back and just to give people, those kids, no matter where they're from, how they grew up, just the eyes, a pair of glasses to be able to see the world differently. I think it's actually getting better. This is a sidebar, just for the kids coming up now, no matter where they come from, because of media and the ability to see a whole bunch of different perspectives all the time, and music and fashion and television and shows and all this other stuff. But for me, it was a little rough until I got into high school. Maybe about junior, senior year, folks were like about to go to college and folks had matured a little bit.
Yeah.
So, you know, nobody bullied anybody or anything at that point. It was just like, oh no, he different, whatever. Yeah. But I was kind of cool in a way by then, by junior, because they knew I played piano. And what I used to do in choir, I used to play like a whole bunch of R&B songs for the girls while before and after choir. I'm like, Brian, please play that Alicia Keys. Play the song that just came out, whatever it was at the time. You know? I think her Diary album had just dropped. This was like 2000. Oh, that was way back. That was my middle school days. But all the way through that, I was always the guy who just kind of serenaded people. And that kept me from being a total lame. But, you know, as far as family and friends goes, they were always extremely supportive because they were just happy to see that I was doing something, you know, to uplift myself, because they come from, especially the older people, aunties, grandma, you know, parents, they come from that generation, especially living down here, that a lot of that stuff was just simply not possible. Mm-hmm. And, you know, not only was it the economic barriers holding you back, you know, the only reason I was able to have even, you know, a decent childhood growing up is because my parents literally killed themselves to get themselves out of the west side of Birmingham into something better for myself. And I'm so grateful. But normally, though, like I said, those old heads, they just rallied behind you. It was a village. And even though they didn't understand a lot of times what I was doing, they understood enough that it was important, that it was something different and something that should be celebrated. And they really got a chance to see this when they came to my recitals. And then when I started, you know, going and doing things with orchestras and letting them hear recordings, it's like, oh my God, you wrote that kind of thing. And now my parents, the most proud moment I've had up until this point is having them be able to come and see what I do for a living, so to speak. And so I think the last time they were able to come out was an Atlanta Symphony concert, and you know, it's not that far from Birmingham, so they actually made the drive and they actually got to see one of my pieces actually premiered by the orchestra. And this was the second night they had played it, so I'd already gone and take my bow the first night, but you know, I dressed up again and everything just for them. So, you know, piece finishes, I run on stage and they got to see, you know, basically how the composer bows in front of all these thousands of people. And they're like, oh my God. And I can imagine what my parents were thinking, having gone through the trajectory of all of what they've experienced, to see something that they created on stage, doing something in an environment that they would have never been, one, welcome in, or two, even felt welcome in.
Mm-hmm.
It's crazy. But
that's so important, because actually I say this all the time, like that was a proud moment for them, because you were able to do that because of what they set up and like before you.
Yeah.
And so I always say, like, you know, I think the work that we're doing, the reason that there's so much weight to it is because it's generational.
That's right.
So, you know, you're doing things for not just Brian Raphael Nabors, but for your parents and even their parents, who set up situation for them to be in a situation to set you up. And you're also doing the work for the next generation, opening doors to show them what is possible and giving them opportunities to see a different perspective and a different occupation, showing them that they can impact the world in a different way so that they can then teach the next generation and next generation. And it's so interesting. I love hearing that, because it really, I say it all the time, but they don't have, like, that's a very, very clear example of that coming through. Like, so indeed, when they see you performing, like, you guys are all winning at the same time.
That's amazing. Good. Yes.
Yeah. Oh, so
gave me a shout in my spirit when you said that. Everybody's winning.
Yes. Yeah,
all the way back on the slave ships. We still, oh gosh.
Right.
We can go all the way back.
All the way.
Yeah. So, like Maya Angelou said, I come as one, but I stand as 10,000. I didn't know what she meant until I got to experience that moment. I was like, oh my God.
Yep.
This is like everything has led up to this. You know, we dig, and we can only dig so far back, but you know, this is for like the 70 something percent of African in me. This is for my folks back in the Congo, my folks back in Senegal.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's for those folks.
We didn't really even really get to talk about your actual composing, because I actually am very curious about
what it takes to actually
put this stuff together. Like, what are you, like, what do you do?
I wish I had my, what you call it around here. I know you're probably not going to show. Oh, I do. I can show you, but you know.
Sorry, audio listeners. I know y'all can't see, but we'll describe it as best as we can. Maybe it's incentive to watch the videos next time. Anyway.
I have a sketchbook that I literally put everything in. Sometimes it comes out as notes. So I don't know if you can see some of this stuff.
I see. Basically, yeah, it looks like a foreign language to me.
Exactly. I was going to say that. This is getting out of hand.
Yeah.
Okay. This is for one movement. This
is that all hand drawn? Or is that all, or like, is the notebook itself have the lines where you can kind of
Okay. It is a full-fledged notebook with about, I think about 8 staves or 9 staves in there that you can just write everything. And sometimes it comes out in paragraph form. Sometimes it comes out as a melody. I could be in the shower, literally, and I hear something and I've jumped out soaking wet, running, dripping with the pencil in my hand, trying to get it down. Because sometimes the spirit will tease you. It'd be like, if you don't get this down, I don't know if I can give it back to you. You figure something out. It may come back in your subconscious even, but it's usually comes out in like a language that only I can decipher. But it comes from just the experience of being out in the world, like we were talking about earlier. Or sometimes something will just hit me, or I may see, you know, some random thing happen, like a leaf fall off a tree or a trash bag.
Yeah.
My friend gave me this book, and it has my face on it. He said, Dr. Neighbor. Yeah. I was like, whoa. And it says, show them who you are. And
that's amazing.
We were thinking about Black Panther at the time. And so there was that fight scene. I think we was fighting old dude from the, tribe? The
Rah-ha! Oh, yeah, I know you.
He's like, show them who you are.
Yes.
Or maybe it was when he was fighting Killmonger. Anyway, the queen, played by Angela Bassett, she was screaming at the time. But every time we think about that, my good friend Alan Lawson, we laugh because we came up with a whole parody that I can't share on it. But it's really fun and encouraging to think about that. Nice. My father, it makes me think of also the connection there, because he always has something he tells me. It's like, well, why not you? Why not you win a Pulitzer Prize? Why not you win, you know, everything, you know? And so that has been a driving force for me as I create this music. But of course, if I had to get into the nitty gritty technical side, it'd take like 24 hours. It's so much. But basically,
no, yeah, I get it.
All the influences, the riffs, the runs, the pulse, the drum patterns, the rhythm. Sometimes I'll give you an even really cool example. I wrote a piece for flute, clarinet, and cello. And the third movement of this kind of 7-dance suite is called Hip Hop Jam. And basically I was thinking of like hip hop or rap from the Kronk era, which is, I guess, we're about the same age around our time of teenage years, where you had 3-6 Mafia, where you had you know, Lil Jon and the East Side Boys, you had T.I., all these like Atlanta-based
Southern
folks. And it was like the sound of the day, you know, that mid to late kind of 2000 sound. And I took this instrumental ensemble with these three instruments, and I made the flute beatbox and become like the snare drum of the 808. And then I made the cello be the bass, you know, that had the pulse and had the hits. So you had the whole beatboxing. I can't demonstrate it because I'm terrible, like that kind of thing. And so these three instruments, you know, flute, clarinet, and cello, made, you know, a lot of references to that sound world. And it's so cool to be able to do that with 80 people or even 80 people plus a choir, mm-hmm. and to like literally lean into that and make it, you know, familiar and really cool. Like we were talking about earlier, but
so I think one of my, we don't have to go into the whole 24-hour lesson breakdown because we don't have much time, but I'm technically minded. So I'm like, are you, mm-hmm. are you writing for each instrument that's going to be in the piece, or is it just you write one like note, I guess, and everything kind of plays out? Like, how does that work?
Ooh, I like that question. Sometimes I'll start with a melody and then it's like, okay. And then sometimes while I'm writing, I'll hear a melody come in. It's like, ooh, that fits well with this kind of groove, this ostinato that keeps going that people can, you know, gravitate towards. And so by then, once you get a groove or like a real idea going in time, a lot of times it's a matter of figuring out how to develop that material and like literally play with people's expectations. So I'm like, okay, this person by this point, my listener has heard this groove for a solid 30 seconds to a minute. I can change up the groove now to divert their expectations, to give them something new or more excited to be about. That's how we get bored. If we hear too much repetition or nothing going on, it's like one sustained tone or a couple of textures that have been normalized for so long that you're craving something new. But the beauty in composition is you can literally plan it like you're a screenwriter for a play. You can put the plot twists in where a person has been used to hearing something for so long, and then all of a sudden you've got this other character of the music. Maybe it's a melody or a certain, you know, melody that has been played for a while, but then you flip it upside down. And it's like, wait a minute. They'll hear it in a different way, but they'll feel the same emotion. They'll feel the same energy, but they won't know why. Unless they're like a serious academic who's looking at the score and all that. But it's literally like playing with people's emotions. It sounds horrible.
No, it's good.
But it's about, I like manipulating it. Sound.
I absolutely. Can see that being really fun too, just for the musicians as well, because they're probably used to playing a certain way. Then they hear it, they're like, oh, this is a little bit more of a challenge, and it's going to be something I never heard before.
Indeed. Oh God, we have to do that all the time with orchestral performance. Like, I've had to teach a whole flute section how to beatbox on the flute before, but that takes me going in and writing program notes in their language, saying,
yeah,
I need you to blow over the mouthpiece in this specific sort of way and say these specific syllables that you see underneath each note in order to get the sound. And then sometimes they'll be really scared, and then when they do it, it's like, is that right? I'm like, that's exactly it. But it's up to us as a composer to write the instructions out in a clear way to fit into this world, you know, that is so different from what you see a whole bunch of performers doing on the street. That's just natural for them, that they don't even have to write down. It's like, well, give me a, what you call it? It's like, that's what they do. I don't know if it was on Bourbon, but this lady, Black woman, was killing it on the clarinet and wailing in ways that I'm sure a lot of these professional people can, but the style, the angle of the breath, everything she's doing. So what me and a lot of my colleagues are doing are trying to take all these different worlds and figure out how to notate them on music staff paper for people to figure out just how to actually get these things to, well, pull these things off. In the concert world, so it can just be kind of a fluid experience, whether you're out on the street or in the concert hall, because it has to change. If it doesn't, you know, we're not asking to throw out the classics and what has made, you know, all this music relevant for the medium of the orchestra or, you know, these instruments, but we're thinking about in terms of what is an American orchestra. If you call yourself, you know, organizations that belong to this country, you have to accept and gravitate towards all the various styles and musical traditions that have built what America is, you know.
You know, one of the last things I'll kind of just say, I'd like to, you know, I'm just going to give you your roses and your flowers.
Appreciate because,
yeah, like, I didn't really care much for contemporary concert style music, if I'm honest. Like, I wasn't, not like I hated it, I just didn't look into it until we kind of started that project together whenever we started working on it. I'm like, oh, this music is really good. And I think I might have even told you, but it felt like the energy around it is so it's so fresh. And it feels like I'm like replaying if you play Xenoblade Chronicles, or have you heard of that before?
I have.
So I'm replaying like the second one right now, and I'm like also listening to your pieces and your movements, and I'm like, man, this is you write scores. Like, you can write scores for video games or film, indeed, anything. It just feels so artistic and so interactive and just so energetic, and it's like, it's a fresh way. I love what you're doing. I don't know if you know, in the jazz realm, I listen to like Christian Scott. I don't know if you know mm-hmm. who that is, but
sounds familiar.
Yeah,
mostly on the jazz funk side, like with Snarky Puppy and all those cats. But
So he's more of like the, we can use the word traditional. He's kind of reinventing that sound, and so I really like what he's doing. So I just really like this reinterpretation of this really old form of art. And like making it new and fresh and bringing new audiences in, because there's another listener here, and I actually talked to other people about this style of music. And so I just want to give you the flowers, man. You're crushing it. So
I appreciate it. Keep digging. I'm so glad that I was able to do that. There are so many sounds within this world. It's crazy, but it's
say. Shoot, honestly too, I'd love some if you have recommendations on who to dig into even further. I love that.
All right, get your notebooks out.
Definitely. There is a guy, he's very experimental. I love his music. A friend and colleague, Tyshawn Sorey.
Okay.
Awesome composer. Another black composer out here working, Carlos Simon. Wonderful composer. Another friend of mine, Evan Williams, really cool music. He wrote a harpsichord concerto.
Okay.
Believe it or not. Really, really cool music. I have so many friends that I can send to you. Definitely. Even if you have like a description box somewhere, I could just load you up with composers.
Yeah, please. I would love that. Love that. Before we go, something I like to do. So I'll give you just like random stuff. And you either taking it, which means like you enjoy it or you can keep it, or we leave it, like you would be fine if this item or thing just was never on the face of the earth again. And you, if you have an explanation for any, why you chose whatever you chose, then you
try not to hold us up, but yeah.
No, it's okay. No, we can go as deep as you want, but it's random stuff. So the first thing that I have comes to mind is cilantro.
Oh, leave it in the pits of Hades. I'm one of those people who have that kind of genetic thing where it tastes directly like soap.
It is
awful to me. Man. I hate cilantro.
I actually like it. I think, I didn't get that bug. It's never tasted like soap. It always enhances whatever I'm eating.
I want to be one of those people. I really do. God. I love Mexican restaurants, but some of them they put the cilantro heavily in the salsa. I'm like, dang.
Yeah.
I have to eat around it and just pretend it's not there.
Like, you know what? I'm not hungry anymore. Oh, cool.
Exactly. I had a bad experience. Yeah. Anyway.
Speaking of food, though, what about pineapple on a pizza?
Oh, God. Yes. I'm taking it. Pineapple.
Interesting.
I don't know why people don't like it. I love the not dichotomy, but the kind of connection between the salt and the sweet. It's great.
It's only good if you have it on that Hawaiian pizza, though. It's got to be
definitely.
It's got to have like the ham on there, because just pineapple on itself is like, well, I'm good.
I definitely agree with that. I've tried it on anything else.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Okay. Let me see if I got one more. Okay. What about those belt clips that people put on their phone, like their phones on their belt clips? You seen those?
I have.
Yeah.
I don't really. I'm indifferent.
Okay.
But I won't put it on me. It's going in my pocket. You know? But if it helps.
Yeah. I understand, like, the phones are just getting massive now. So, like, some people.
Yeah.
can't even fit them in their pockets no more.
That's true.
Especially women. I know women, because they have smaller anyway, like there's nothing they can do. But I do think the belt clip, it's just a little outdated. Just like, stop. Just hang on to it. Or like, I mean, you know, fanny packs are cool and how. So just put those on and put it in one of their, I don't know.
Hey, cool. I mean, hey, y'all in it, that kind of, I ain't going to put it on. You do what you do. No shame to anybody who likes fanny packs. Yeah, just get you a nice case. They have the little wallets that protect the screen if you want to put it in a pocket, but it's whatever.
Yeah.
I'm indifferent.
Fair enough. All right. One more thing. I wanted to hear from you. In the work and the things that you're doing, what is it that you kind of want to communicate to folks just in general?
That we are one. It's so cliche, but to immediately love each other more because of how different we are and because of just how amazing it is that all of us in our various respective lives and cultures can coexist, and that it's actually possible to do all of that. To love, I don't want to say in spite of, but because of. That's it.
Yeah, that's right on, man. I couldn't agree anymore, man. I appreciate it. Well, again, Brian, appreciate your time. Thank you so much.
Absolutely, dude.
Okay, so are y'all fans yet? Nah, for real, shout out to Brian, man. Thank you for just being so generous with your time and just being so passionate about the work that you're doing, the strides that you're making for the community, man. This is huge. And man, appreciate you just being willing to share the music with us. I know y'all liked it. So if y'all want to hear some more, just go to his website. I got links to all of his stuff, all the places you can find him in the description. Go find it, be fans, go to a show, support. Thank y'all for supporting this podcast, man. I really appreciate it. If you shared, if you listened to an episode, if you watched a video, anything, man, all the support is so good. Continue to share with folks, man. We need people to hear this. And if you have suggestions or anything, just feel free to reach out and find me on email at whatsupasa@gmail.com, or find me on Instagram at timspod, T-I-M-S-P-O-D. Just to let me know what y'all think about the show, suggestions, anything. I'm still looking for an editor. I'm telling y'all, we got a lot of stuff coming down the pipeline. So if you got any suggestions for folks, hit me up on those same channels. But that's all I got for y'all right now. I appreciate each and every one of y'all. Y'all are so great, fantastic. So before I go, you know I gotta tell you, none of us have any idea what we're doing. We just become better actors. And with that, I pray that y'all stay safe. Peace.